My name is Gary Butterfield.
My name is Cole Ross.
You're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs. It is a Games Club podcast. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year 2024. We'll try and do okay.
Yeah. Looking forward to a year of election nightmare stuff.
Yeah. We can be a refuge, maybe. We'll still be cranky
hopefully
about stuff.
We'll do our best.
But we're starting off strong. This week, we're talking about The Case of the Golden Idol, which is a detective game developed by Color Gray Games and published by PlayStack for the PC and Switch in 2022.
Yeah, a cool pick.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good game, and it's also, I'm going to say, one of the things I realized about this, I'm very picky about detective games.
Mm-hmm.
This is a detective game in a real sense.
Yeah.
One of the most detective games that I have played.
Mm-hmm.
And not just contrasting with games that are called detective games, which I don't really think involve detective work.
Right.
This involves real detective work.
You're the Sinking Cities and whatnot, which is about
Cities and Paradise Killers.
Yeah.
And stuff.
This is a rare bird. This is kind of in the valley of the Return of the Oberdin, like
just Oberdin.
Yeah.
Wow, how did it take you that long to find that?
It's the only comparison point. It's just the one. Yeah. There's also Hypnospace in this a little bit. Yeah. Without the time period pastiche kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I relish this. I didn't have time to play the DLC before this, you know, doing other stuff to prepare for break. We're recording this before Christmas. Really hungry for anything more in this vein.
Yeah, I think this is an excellent execution of it.
Mm-hmm.
And my second favorite, if we consider Hypnospace, my second favorite execution of it. I like this more than I like Oberdin.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked Oberdin a lot.
Yes.
I think I have a less of a natural hunger.
Mm-hmm.
For it. It's a sometimes treat for me, but like the operative word is treat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when I'm in the mood for this, I'm really, you know, I think it's really fun.
Yeah.
For sure.
The leaps of intuition, and like getting over like the chaff that's in the detail in this, they're so good. Just everything is executed like to create these lanes of deduction for you. To kind of arrive at these answers here, in addition to being like a really good presentation and a fun story.
The story is really cool. The things it deals with, I think. The deduction lanes, the types of puzzles that this allows for, I think the batting average is way above average.
Mm-hmm.
Like every once in a while, we end up with something that feels to me like just a logic grid.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized the kind of thing that for me, a detective game, I need it to be as far away from Sudoku as possible.
Yeah.
If I'm ever doing anything that remotely resembles Sudoku, I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that Oberdin had some Sudoku parts. This has a couple of Sudoku adjacent things that are not my favorite,
mm-hmm.
but that's just me. That's not even really a problem with the game.
No.
It's just the type of junior jumbles I like. You know, like, you know, the type of deduction puzzles I like.
Mm-hmm.
Like if it's something about plot and story and character that I can deduce, I'm into it.
No.
If it ends up being about, you know, just a fact or figure, I'm less.
yeah,
into it.
Yeah.
You know, there's like whether you're doing the formula, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a joy to a formula that comes with a lot of grids where it's like, you know, the thing to do, you just go through the steps.
Yeah.
That's always rough on me. Mm-hmm. This game resorts to that very infrequently.
Yeah.
Less frequently than Oberdin does and other games that have, you know, called themselves detective games before, yeah. I think.
For as narrow as the interaction model is on this, you know, you are clicking on things to discover stuff and then gathering words. We'll talk about that. But for as narrow as the interaction is, the actual, like, breadth of puzzles is pretty wide.
Yeah, oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the difference in this, and we'll talk about these key differences, and the reason why we're getting so much preamble out of the way is because this is something that, if it's your thing,
mm-hmm.
It's good to go into it pretty blind,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
But the differences between this and Oberdin, and I'm going to keep making that comparison, because it's hard not to.
It calls for it. They specifically cite it as inspiration. They wanted to see more games like it, so they made one.
And it's the thing we've done that's the most like it.
Yes.
You know, so even, you know, much more so than Hypnospace,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I'm going to keep comparing it to Oberdin. The differences between this and Oberdin allow for a greater variety of puzzle types.
Yeah.
Than this. And a lot of those are really in my alley. Super cool game.
Yeah.
You just play yourself. You're an omniscient third-party ghost observer to these various scenes, and you're solving a mystery mm-hmm. about this golden idol. As it changes hands over the course of 40 years. And that is the biggest, you know, the first big difference
mm-hmm.
between this. We're going to be jumping through time.
Yes.
This is a long story.
Yeah. And it is set largely in this alternate history version of the 18th century in basically England. Mm-hmm. And the primary characters, you know, we're going to be following this kind of backstabbing Cloudsley family and then learning about this secret society called the Brotherhood and how they relate to this golden idol.
Yes.
Yeah.
There are 11 cases and an epilogue, and you get a semi-frozen scene, like mm-hmm. semi-animated.
Yeah.
There, generally involving someone's death in these, like someone has died. So they're murder mysteries, but you're trying to find out more than just a murder.
Yeah.
In these. And the mechanics are pretty light.
Mm-hmm.
The idea here is you can see everything in the scene. You know, you can rifle through pockets,
mm-hmm.
Things like that. And you just figure out what's happened.
Right.
You know, sometimes that will be broken down in different ways, but you are finding out what happens. And these generalities as such are going to be fairly brief. And the body of the episode will actually be pretty brief too, because mm-hmm. it's hard to describe the process of deduction.
Right.
You know, or at least not hard. It's not interesting.
Right.
You know, to describe the process of deduction.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual like things that happened and a couple of those standout leaps are really cool.
Yeah.
You can figure out what in the scene takes you down the rabbit, you know, the breadcrumb trail
mm-hmm.
to make that breakthrough.
Yeah. Getting that one realization late into trying to put things together that recontextualizes stuff that you, you know, kind of glanced over before. Wonderful moments. So there are two modes to this. There's exploring mode and there's thinking mode. Explore mode, it's like an adventure game. You are looking around at these scenes, clicking on stuff to get a closer view, also looking inside containers, reading documents, seeing close-ups on people, and getting a little bit of their dialogue, which also provides information. And if you're playing this, I very highly recommend turning on the highlight mode. Pixel hunting would kill this for me.
I don't know why they it's even an option.
Yeah.
Not to have it on the Switch version, at the very least, it defaults to it being on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why they would take that off.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that game. It's not interesting. And the art style, as much as like, I think the art style in this is an acquired taste. Like mm-hmm. I've heard people really be revolted by it. I like it in a Maniac Mansion kind of way.
Yeah.
It would make this hard.
Yeah.
It would make pixel hunting hard.
Yes.
You're searching not only for, you know, these objects to search through, you're finding underlined words.
Yeah.
And these represent, people, details, objects, verbs, things like that, that will eventually be kind of mad libbed into your story.
Right. Yeah. And as you find these, they're added to a tray at the bottom of the screen. You can keep them organized, which I like, you know, mm-hmm. so you can keep first and last names together. And keep it straight. So it's not just a full jumble. Thankfully the game will tell you when you've gathered all of the possible words across all the screens. So some of these are multi-screen mysteries. And also the interaction dots over stuff will let you know if you have found everything within a source. So it's pretty easy to go back and look and see where the missing thing is. It's not a collect-a-thon.
Yep. Once you have these, you go into thinking mode. And this presents you with a worksheet. Like, again, kind of a Mad Lib. This will almost always be like who killed who and how.
Mm-hmm.
But then there'll be little side, you know, little side hustles as well that will inform the former. The slots that you can put words into are color-coded.
Mm-hmm.
So you know if this is looking for a name or a noun or a verb.
Yeah.
I would say this is a better game to play on PC than Switch.
Yeah.
You know, playing a case before bed every night is nice, but the interface is, you know, you're still using a analog stick to move a mouse cursor around.
Yeah.
That's not the most fun thing in the world. I think this would be a lot more fun with a mouse.
Anytime. I mean, it's great that the Switch is there. It would probably be a little bit better on Steam Deck. But even then, it's kind of like trying to eat a Snickers bar with chopsticks. Like
it almost exactly trying to play Mac Ventures with an NES.
Yeah.
You know, it's which works and you do it for the soundtrack and to be able to play in bed, but it's not ideal.
Yeah. You're placing these into the slots. I got a sinking feeling when I played this because when I put it on the schedule, I completely neglected to look back at it for a colorblind check. Can you give me rods and cones report?
Give you the strong proton report. Strong proton reporting for duty. We'll fight the deutrons. No, it's fine.
Okay.
There's enough contrast in it and just enough context. Like I very rarely relied on the colors. So maybe that, you know, there's no counterfactual. Like I haven't been able to play this with functioning eyes. So maybe it would have been easy for me, but generally the type of word was suggested by the container and the words around the container to me more than the color.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So it just didn't come up that often, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. That's cool. Thinking mode, you've got these kind of smaller clues that you're filling out, like little worksheets. Most often this is identifying everybody in the scene.
That's in almost all of them.
Yes.
And then there's usually like a Joker's Wild one per scene, like a new scene specific one.
Yeah. And you complete the stage by filling out this big final answer that summarizes what happened. And it's worth looking at that first as well to understand a little bit of what's expected of you, you know, to put together, because oftentimes, the leaps that you need to make are not immediately led to in the smaller, clue panels. Yeah.
I didn't for the way I played, and this again, this could just be a gamer-o type thing. The game isn't. It's worth noting the game isn't prescriptive about that.
Right.
Like you don't have to do one before the other. I flip flopped between thinking and exploring constantly, and filled these out really, really haphazardly.
Yeah.
Other than figuring out who everyone was, that was always my first step. And then once I did that, I just kind of followed my nose, I guess. For these, it wasn't about one of them informing the other. Very often it was more just, it was more holistic, I guess.
Yeah.
Was how I approached it. So the only reason I bring that up is not to fight any Pokemons or anything, but just to make sure that anyone who hasn't played this game who's thinking about picking it up, it's not prescriptive in that.
Yeah.
You can swap back and forth between these anytime you want. You can fill them out in any order you like.
Yeah. And you want to do that because you want to keep things in context rather than just, you know, having everything build up, all those words there. Thankfully, this pulls a cue from Oberdin. It will let you know. It'll let you know when you're absolutely wrong in the stuff that you've played out. But it'll also let you know when you're very close. So there's red for just like, hey, this thing is messed up. When only two things are wrong, oftentimes just switched. Like, oh, you've got the wrong first name on these two or whatever. It will go into a yellow state. So there's red, there's yellow, and then there's green for solved. I like that. That is a useful amount of distinction.
Yeah, two or less, two or fewer are wrong is nice.
Yeah.
You can learn a lot from that when you get down to a process of elimination kind of thing. You know, I think I'm wrong with this. If I swap it out for something, does it turn to red? That means that's not the one yeah. I think I have wrong.
Right.
Things like that. Mm-hmm. When you run into these, one of my, I have a minor nit with this game, which is its hint system. Mm-hmm. In the game, there is a hint system mm-hmm. in the game. It will give you hints. They're good hints. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't end up using them a lot, and I'll tell you why. I did end up looking up hints later because I'm not a puzzle guy necessarily.
No.
In the in-game engine makes you solve a preschooler object match puzzle what? To get a hint.
That's yeah, weird.
It shows a word. It's like, you know, drag the fan over to the image of the fan.
Huh.
Drag that, and there's like 12 of them or 14 of them. It's exceedingly condescending.
Yeah.
It presents it as earn your hint.
Solve this.
And then tries to stop you from doing it before you do it. It's like, we really think you shouldn't do this.
Uh-huh.
If you want to do it, have this little, you know, baby game punishment.
Yeah.
So you feel stupid for doing it.
Solve this shapes order. Yeah.
It's exactly that. So yeah. I think that's vile.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like that as a perspective on a dev.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like the way that this dev, it's a fun success story. You know, mm-hmm. this dev, like the development story is nice. It's a good game.
Yeah.
And they're interested in interesting things. I wish that they would have beat that part of themselves out.
Yeah.
Before putting out a game, like never do that. Mm-hmm. There's no reason.
No, you know? Nothing to be gained.
Yeah. Nothing to be gained. You haven't done anything. You haven't mm-hmm. succeeded in anything except for like, you know, just me. And like I said, I ended up using it. And then eventually later, at a certain point, I hit like I get it buttons on a couple things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'm real close to this. I want to go to bed.
Yeah.
And I would look up. The nice thing is the internet has just provided those hints, so you don't have to go through the supplicant store to get them. I can just read the hints it gave me,
yep.
which I ended up doing specifically for the last mega puzzle
mm-hmm.
that is over a really, like at a certain point, the scope got really big.
Yeah.
And, you know, got a little bit overwhelming for me and ended up using those. And I'll be damned if I'm going to crawl to the dev and do a little junior jumble for it.
No.
Get fucked.
The hints are all in the form of guiding questions, which is
yes, nice. Which are great. That's mm-hmm. the best way. The hints themselves are actually really good.
Yeah.
It's just a little like, okay, well put on the chicken hat if you want to have them. Mm-hmm. You know, can you prove object permanence? You know, here's a ball. You can bounce it if you wish. It's literally that as a perspective. And that gave me a real bad taste in my mouth the first time I saw that. And I had to, took me a little bit to shake it off.
Yeah. Oh. So like we said, the mysteries that you're solving are really varied and they do expand in scope and complexity over the course of the game, to my mind nicely, but you're not the only person I've heard who gets overwhelmed by those, by that last one.
It's just more than I want, I guess. Yeah. And that's not a thing on the game. It's mm-hmm. just my preferences for how much of a puzzle fuck I am.
Yeah.
You know, and it's part of the thing that, again, contrasting this with Oberdin, one of the things I like about it, and one of the things that people who much prefer Oberdin feel the other way, is that they really like that feels like it's more of one big puzzle
mm-hmm.
That goes together and you're exploring one big space.
Yeah.
I really like this being presented as scenes. I like these puzzles being broken down
mm-hmm.
into individual, more discrete things.
Yeah.
That works a lot better for my brain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you could, and I can be stupid. That can be dumb, you know, of me, but that's just how I have fun.
Both approaches have their appeal. I think that there's no other way to do it with this goal of telling a long scope story like this.
You
know, core mysteries about like what happens to who and when. You can only do it by telling the story chronologically. So that is I think worthwhile. But both approaches have value. You end up like getting these mysteries that have, you know, they're pulled from like tried and true tropes. So like there's a locked room mystery. There's, you know, the poisoning death at the party. You know,
there's 100% the who's eating what and who's sitting next to who at a table.
Uh-huh.
Jindosh lock thing, which is my bane. That does exist.
And then there are other ones that are a little bit more mechanical, learning about the golden idol itself, some like intricacies and customs, you know, things like that, what different symbols mean.
There's a hilarious bit where you're straight up just doing algebra.
Uh-huh.
You're just solving for X multiple times. Like there is just an algebra worksheet.
I'm just
about two-thirds of the way through this game.
Sitting here rubbing my hands together. I'm a good boy and I need points.
I ended up liking it. Those were really intuitive to me. Like, mm-hmm. Like that was also a thing too, where it's like, I'm a dumb dumb, but that level of math is very intuitive to me.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that these are small mysteries that eventually constitute a larger story.
Yes.
You know, you learn about these stories, but it unravels very properly.
Yes.
You know, you have this sense of constant zooming out.
Mm-hmm.
And as it goes, one of the advantages this has over a different approach for this is that you start getting familiar with characters and intuition becomes a little bit easier because you're like, I'm like, oh, this guy's a fucking mountebank. Like this guy's an agent.
Yeah.
You know, that's what this guy does. He is sent out to do, you know, I don't know the whole story at all. I just know this guy is a scumbag who gets sent out to do things.
Oh, it's that fucking guy.
So what
guy.
Is this guy doing?
Yeah.
It's that fucking guy. Oh shit, he's a different name, but it's that fucking guy. He's here because he's up to no good. He's working for this guy.
Yeah.
You know, you get this story context that helps you. It's never necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Like all of these you could solve on their own.
Yeah.
As little individual things, but having that narrative helps it appeal more to my, you know, my right brained sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
We mentioned the art style. I'm very much in favor of it. I like how gonky this is. It is this, you know, detailed pixel art that I find to be super expressive. Individual faces, have, you know, big movements, and the fact that everything is captured in a still, there's really good, like, pose work going on. It conveys a bunch of stuff by being very distinctive. It helps me latch on to individual details better. I could understand somebody saying, like, everything here is an asymmetrical mess. What is this? Yeah.
Like, they look like ghoulies.
Yeah.
You know, they look like Land of Confusion. Puppets. Ask your parents. That was a video by Genesis in the 80s. They look like Land of Confusion puppets, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, they're really ugly. That's what Maniac Mansion is what it reminds me of. Like, if you were to up-res Weird Ed, you know, as a grotesque little goblin man.
Yeah.
There. It works for me as well, but I didn't end up having as strong an opinion about it as a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it works. It's functional.
Yes.
For me. But there's even the color palette as well is really kind of sickly.
Yeah.
In a lot of scenes, like there is a sense of off-putting scudge to this.
Yeah. And the music's good. I really like the earwormy kind of tunes we got going on here. Mm-hmm. It's a Ukrainian musician, Kyle Misko, who did the composition for this.
Yeah. Sounds good. I ended up playing this a lot on mute because I was playing it in bed next to my wife, but I did listen to the soundtrack. It's good.
Yeah. As far as making of details go, I pulled details. There was an interview that the publisher did with the developers, PlayStack, the publisher. There's also an interview that Joel Couture did for GameDeveloper.com. So this studio, Color Gray Games, we got another two-hander. This is Latvian brothers, Ernest and Andre Klavans are the name of them. Yeah.
No longer just a coffee line. Uh-huh. It's now a developer, Latvian Brothers. Andreas did the programming, and Ernest did the graphic design.
Yes.
And they were inspired by Oberdin,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they were wondering why there weren't more games like it.
Yes. Specifically, they kind of honed their thinking on detective games by watching Game Maker's Toolkit on YouTube, you know, so that's fun. And they started putting this together. They prototyped it and pretty much started testing stuff right away, kind of relying on interviews with the testers more than anything, more than like data or whatever, just to try and smooth things out, untangle knots that were getting in the way of these, these deduction paths that they wanted people to follow.
Yeah. For visuals, what they went for was evoking the nostalgia of 90s adventure games. So, you know, that makes sense. But then also taking inspiration from 18th and 19th century painters like Gustave Doré, William Hogarth, specifically social commentators who this is about the gentry.
Yes.
And being full of crapulence.
Yeah.
This is a fairly class conscious game.
I was not familiar with those artists just based on the name. But if you go and look at their works, you can definitely see it. I think specifically Hogarth, like the paintings are like big and full of action, you know, showing like just debauched nobles, in the middle of revelry and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really does pull from there, you know, if not like, you know, this isn't painterly in style, but in composition, right?
Yeah.
So this was released to really positive reviews, and it was nominated for a ton of awards. It was kind of this, you know, surprise hit that the developers were very pleasantly, you know, pleasantly surprised to see that people responded to it well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are two DLCs. We're not covering them for this episode. We want to have a Christmas. They're also just, they're prequel stories, and they're just chapters. Mm-hmm. So it's a little extra content, but it doesn't, we get a complete story here.
Yes.
The two DLCs are the Spider of Lanka and the Lemurian Vampire. Mm-hmm. Both of which, again, well received as more of the same.
Yes.
If you want to see a take on those, Will Hughes, my friend, who I do Everything to Guppy with, has reviewed, the DLCs and this game for the AV Club.
Yeah. It was, Will's review that, that brought my attention to this.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can check out takes on the DLC there.
Mm-hmm. The WAF effect strikes again, right as we put this on the schedule, or right as it was coming up, the Hated Game Awards, there was an announcement that a sequel is coming out, Rise of the Golden Idol, taking place in the 1970s instead of the 1770s.
So I was a little disappointed they were doing the same storyline. Like, mm-hmm. I wanted them to take the same engine, mm-hmm. and concept and switch, not have it have to do with the Golden Idol, mm-hmm. and all that stuff. But then them doing it in the 1970s got me back.
Yeah.
That's pretty exciting because mm-hmm. it's not an era that you see a lot of stuff in.
No, especially games.
Yeah. It's a weird era for this mm-hmm. kind of thing. It's like a supernatural detective game that takes place in the 70s.
Beats still my heart.
Yeah. That is a cool idea. So like as much as I don't have a limitless thirst for this kind of thing, like I will need a refractory period mm-hmm. before I check that out. I'm interested. I'm following along.
Yeah.
That's going to be it for generalities. We're going to get into it. Final spoiler wall.
Yeah. This.
If you like detective games, I think this is worth playing.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the best and one of the most true, like, you do detective shit in this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, your mechanics are paying attention, making deductions, drawing connections between different seemingly disparate elements.
Yeah.
You know, recognizing patterns, all these things that detectives do. It's mm-hmm. not just a code for it being a mystery story.
Yeah.
You know,
fans of Oberdin and Hypnospace, Run, Don't Walk.
Yeah. It's if you think of it as like if I think about it as the storytelling to Sudoku spectrum,
mm-hmm.
with Oberdin on the Sudoku side and Hypnospace on the story side, it's in the middle of those two.
Yeah.
Like you're going to get a little less character and heart, or mm-hmm. a lot less heart and a little less character than Hypnospace.
Yeah.
Then you're going to get that, but it is not quite as mechanically focused as Oberdin, or like mm-hmm. sterile.
Yeah, yeah.
As Oberdin, personalities come into play more. And stories happen in people. People mm-hmm. are great. Let's get into it.
Let's do. We have chapter one, Complications in the Family, and we have a very simple prologue called An Abrupt Termination of a Contract, where the questions are small, and it's pretty clear what's going on. We have a man falling off of a cliff and another person who pushed him as this
That's
storm.
A classic red herring is what we like to call those.
And just to make it clear that this is intentional, the one who's falling screams, I knew what you were plotting, you snake. So this is a cold-blooded murder here.
Or is it? I think this case is primarily teaching you where to look and how to look.
Yeah.
You know, so the guy doing the push-in, says that we look in the contract in his pocket and we learn that he's on an expedition agreement and we get names.
Right.
So Albert Cloudsley Esquire funded this expedition. Dr. Oberon Geller found the map on the site of Monkey's Paw Island. be careful what you wish for. The falling man has a scalpel in his pack. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, okay, that's the doctor.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The map has an X near these ruins. That's where we must be.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
Yeah. So, and the doctor, who's up on the, you know, who did the push in, he's, or no, sorry, it was the lawyer who did the push in.
Yeah,
doctor's
the
push
in is what you meant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
the doctor's pack, has the golden idol in it, but it's not observable. This golden idol is going to be kind of a background. It's going to be kind of a background detail for these first two cases before it becomes the central focus of everything. But there's also a bag of gems. Like this is, this has been fruitful. Then we go into thinking mode and we've got to identify these guys. We've got to locate where this murder happened. I like mm-hmm. this because we've got a map of the, of all the environs around this. And we can tell, by looking in the background, specifically like, okay, we're on an island off of this portion, you know, off the coast of the Horn of Thumb on this Monkey's Paw Island.
Or we're on a horn with these islands off the coast.
Yeah.
Rather.
Yeah.
So we can see those islands so we can intuit where we're at on the map.
Mm-hmm.
Good tutorial.
Yeah.
On this. Very slight uptick here. The next part is the untimely passing of a rural gentleman.
God, I love these titles.
they're very, like there's a cadence to them that reminds me of something.
Mm-hmm.
Like something else is titled like this.
No.
But I'm having a hard time remembering exactly what I'm thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
A man's dead. He's got a head wound. He's on his bed in a manor bedroom. And a window outside shows a river and a sailboat. And then every once in a while, a horse runs by.
Yeah.
There. And the horse has a saddle.
Yeah. And we've got to, while the horse is there, inspect it to see, you know, to see what it has. Yeah. It is August 23rd, according to this calendar, and a portrait on the wall shows this guy, in blue. He's wearing his wig and he's eating chicken.
I love the painted portrait of me. Can you take a painted portrait of me just eating an entire leg of chicken?
I need to establish that, this is my eating clothes,
my eating outfit,
which is exactly what this is. We have to use his clothing to determine what he was doing, and determine the nature of the accident. This isn't a murder. It's death by misadventure. But there are a couple of different ways
different
that he could have died.
Misadventures. This is where they introduce the red herring thing. I think that it gets a little too obvious with this sometimes.
Yeah.
Like each puzzle having just a very, very obvious red herring in the beginning starts feeling a little formulaic to me.
Yeah.
Because he is next to, on the bed, he's next to a teetering broken ladder. I get them doing it here because in the last one, they showed somebody pushing. This one, they're showing something that has almost the same relationship and saying like, no, you have to look a little deeper than that.
Yeah.
But then they kind of keep doing it and it gets a little bit, you know, cutesy. I don't know what the word is for it.
To me,
it ends up feeling a little bit like I can see the formula.
You just learn to ignore the first thing that you notice.
Yes.
Right. You know, it just, you establish a heuristic.
Rote. Yeah. 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 It becomes a little rote in a way that I think once they figured out, once they taught the lesson, they could stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like to me.
Yeah.
This is Sebastian Cloudsley. We learn that from a treatise he wrote on spontaneous combustion. More on that later.
Yep.
we see the golden idol off in the corner. And the main thing we need to do to figure out where he is and which attire is his, like what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
We know he's not researching at the time of his death because his researching attire is on the chair.
Yeah.
It's covered with these chemicals and burns.
Yeah. So he was out hunting. Right.
Yep.
We got to figure out, you know, using the map, like who Cloudsley is the lord of. He's this lord of Blackfield. We can tell that by observing a river through there. And the cause of death is unclear. It seems like it's going to be the ladder, but the blood doesn't lead from the ladder to the bed. The blood actually leads from the door.
Well, and the other thing too, when I contrast this with other detective games, the thing that I figured out was, oh, there's a horse with a saddle running by wildly.
Mm-hmm.
Like that doesn't happen when, you know,
everything's
like,
good
naturally. Yeah, like, oh, somebody fell off that horse.
Yeah,
you know, and seeing that falling off from a horse was an option, that's where I got it from. You know, so they're having kind of multiple avenues to figure this out, and the kind of things you're noticing, it's more than just plug and play different values like an equation. It's making those little like, oh, that's not noticing something unusual.
Yeah.
Can be part of the puzzle solving.
Yeah. Noticing something unusual. Those are both like mutually reinforcing. So like, all right, just the horse running with the saddle, like anything could have happened. It could have escaped, right? That could be circumstantial.
The rapture.
A very specific rapture.
Horse rapture.
Coupled with him in his riding clothes and also the fact that the blood is leading from the door and thus ruling out the ladder, all of those reinforce and say like, yes, this is precisely what happens.
And you're a little silly for him just to have a broken ladder next to his bed all the time, you know, but we get little cutscenes every once in a while in between these. These are useful and good, but they don't make any sense until you know the whole story really.
Right.
You know, you would benefit from rewatching them.
Mm-hmm.
And the nature of this game of picking it up and putting it down, either when you get stumped or when you're kind of done with a case, made reviewing the story. I think that's what made the last chapter a little odious for me.
Yeah.
Was there just so many characters I was keeping in my head at that point, and just a lot of things that had happened. Like it maybe been a couple days and I had to pick it back up and like review.
Mm-hmm.
So we get this little cutscene. It shows a few people who have attended the funeral. There's a wide-eyed, mustachioed man, a heavy woman, and a scheming-looking guy in these round glasses.
Yeah,
they're going to be important for this next chapter.
Looks kind of like the husband in Courage the Cowardly Dog. Looks like Eustace.
I've never even seen that show, but I know who you're talking about, the old guy.
Yeah, the old guy.
Yeah.
And we get to the most, you know, really dramatic chapter here. This is the famous scene. Like, this is the promo image that they use for it. The dramatic departure of an outsider. And it's clear who died and how. We've got a man burning alive in this village right by a stable. As another man is pointing the golden idol at him, and everybody is looking at this completely shocked.
Yes. This has two scenes. You collect the clues outside and you collect the clues inside. Mm-hmm. Inside, the large woman and a lawyer are talking. There's a fireplace that's been used recently with tons of scraps of paper around it. We are still in ramping us up.
Yes.
Because the lawyer just has a will in his pocket that lists all the names and stuff. It's real great. The burning man has a scorched horse brush on him. Mm-hmm. And the man with the idol says, "If it's all the same to you, I'll take my leave."
Badass thing to say after lighting a man on fire.
Pretty cool.
And he has instructions on how to use this. This is it mentioned spontaneous combustion, so that has popped up. Sebastian Cloudsley was not just a kook talking about pseudoscience or whatever. This was very specific research that he was doing. It relates to this idol. And this is where we learn how the idol works by programming in these symbols on the back. And then pulling a lever. And the document here says you have to cast a freezing spell first in order to light something on fire. And this is teaching you a principle here that's going to become much clearer in a later case.
Yeah, at this point, I didn't get it.
Right.
Like, I don't know if that makes me a dum-dum, but I didn't, you know, at this point, I was like, okay, that seems arbitrary, but I didn't know what was going on.
Yes.
A cool thing with the a good intuitive leap of this is that you end up finding out there are twins in the mix. The knives on the burning man and the person sitting next to them have initials, and you learn about the pair brothers.
Yes.
There. And so I'm like, okay, you learn they're twins. There are no twins.
No.
Except there's one person who we can't see their face.
Right,
that must be the other twin. Because he's on fire. That must be the other twin.
Yeah.
You know? And we find out their last name from a doodle in front. You can also find there's their schedule on the horse on the manger door.
Yeah.
There as well, this information comes up a couple different places.
Yeah.
That's how you identify the pair brothers.
There's a ratty looking guy back by the stables. This guy's going to keep popping up. His name is David Goran. And he's got a note saying, "Hey, prepare the carriage for tomorrow. We are to visit my nephew, EC." So, you know, this guy is going to be in line with somebody, subordinate to, EC. We're going to find out it's Edmund Cloudsley. That's the guy with the round glasses. He is up observing, this idol in use. Saying what an unexpected turn of events. And like articles say, like, oh, he's a member of parliament. Like, this is somebody who is placed, you know, relatively high up in civilian government.
Yeah. Inside there's embroidery on the wall that talk about these three families, the Batleys, the Cloudsleys, and the Cuberts, and get their sigil. So we can figure out who is here. Based on the sigil on their door.
This is the Cloudsley house because there's a dragon on the front.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They have that sigil there. The large woman has all these exotic items on her. She's a Cubert. She has the palm tree crest, but we can also learn from the will.
Yeah.
Where she's traveled recently, because the will that we have has the family tree and the will have information about the individual family members.
Right.
Like personality and like things they've done.
So she's been living in the colonies for a while, kind of in this universe's equivalent of India is what this is.
Going through all the stuff that's on the floor, all the scraps of paper, and we learn this is Sebastian Cloudsley's will, which gives us those descriptions, and we get the first of many just absolutely slamming Peter Batley. Piece of shit. I love Peter Batley in this.
I love the way his story wraps up. It's so good.
It's very Coen Brothers. The whole thing is very Coen Brothers. Peter Batley is a deadbeat.
Yeah.
You know, he's in debt. He's constantly just writing people to ask them to borrow money. Just, you know, from a wealthy family, but not able to make anything of himself.
Yeah. Anywhere he goes, you can tell he's been there because there are these horse betting slips.
Yes.
Around. Yep.
And he always has no money in his pocket.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So he's the, you know, the son of Sebastian's sister. So he's a nephew here. Piece of shit. Edmund Cloudsley, that's easy enough to identify him based on, based on relations, you know, EC, and being the boss of David Gorin, this coachman, right? You know, he's got a saddlebag.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Rose is identified, you know, by those possessions that you mentioned. Willard Wright is identified by elimination.
Yeah.
You know, we have one person left.
And that is very important. Willard Wright, nobody knew about this guy. And then suddenly, here he comes getting this mysterious thing, the completely unclear relation between the two of them.
Associate.
Yes.
Yeah. figure out who was left what, by reading the will. The Rose, the sister who left for the colonies, got the bulk of the estate. You know, mm-hmm. I knew this because of all the things she had on her. Edmund, the politician, received the research on astronomy. Peter, who is a piece of shit, got a book of aphorisms, which, you know, he feels very insulted by that. That's going to provide motivation, even though motivation doesn't come up until the next.
That's one of the red herrings on this, because like the sentence at the start is blank was upset that they received blank.
Yes.
And I would be most upset if I was in debt and I got a book of advice.
Yes.
So that seems like more of a motivation than Edmund being upset that he got the astrology stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
So then we have to fill out, you know, that story, like what happened. Here. So, Peter or Edmund were upset that what they got in the will, they ordered their stable hands under their control to stop them. And then, Willard set Adam on fire.
Yeah.
Using the idol.
So, demonstrating it and raising the curiosity of Edmund. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. This brings us into chapter two. I have two favorite cases in this. This is one of them. The murder of the Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
The other one is the one with the cliff.
Oh, yeah.
My two favorite. So this is a murder scene at an inn. We start out on the second floor. The victim has been stabbed in the gut while sleeping. The window is open. There's a watchman ringing an alarm outside with broken glass at his feet.
Yeah. Important detail. Glass doesn't. So somebody broke out from there.
Yes.
And there's writing on the wall in blood. Revenge, RR, is written up there. And the door is locked from the inside. Somebody had to get in, lock it from the inside. And it's pretty clear they got in through a trapdoor from the other room through the attic into this one.
Yes. Pocket Watch identifies the victim as Maurice. The Golden Idol's case is empty, so we can assume what was taken.
Mm-hmm.
The victim was writing a letter to his master saying that their departed brother left them a keepsake to bestow onto their brotherhood. Mm-hmm. May Griffin awaken, proud beast initiate.
Yeah.
This is where the first, like, you know, cults.
Mm-hmm.
This cult sucks. They're really about like, shitty rules and like bylaws and everything. But then what they ultimately do once the cool guy gets in power is good and spooky.
Yes.
The
other room is empty. The bed is cold. And out the window, we can see a shady looking guy, in a hood, asking like, hey, why did that bugger give me a note when he knows I can't read? The note says like, hey, lay low nearby. And saying we can look and see he's got one half of a pair of scissors and some stale bread on him. So he's been, you know, he has possibly, something that could have been used to stab. Yeah. And a little bit of like, you know, payment and food here.
Yeah. But somebody gave him a thing. This is the first time like explicit framing is happening. It's going to happen a lot.
Yeah.
When red herrings dovetail with framing. For things, I like that. It's consonant where it's like trying to fool the player and trying to fool characters in the world.
Yes.
Like those are good red herrings. This is a good one.
Yeah.
Down in the tavern, there are people playing cards while a man plays the fiddle and a barkeep watches. The bar is locked from the inside. You know, bad business.
Yeah. Perspective. Hey, dummy. the quickest bar rescue ever.
Yeah. You know that sign that says we have Coors? You know? It says close, Charlie. Your literacy. We do a quick intervention on your literacy. There's a wanted poster that identifies this guy named Robert Redruth, who looks like a half wolf man.
He does. He's got the big round yellow eyes.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, revenge, RR. you know, this, but that guy can't read.
Yeah.
He's mumbling. He's walking down the street mumbling that he can't read. so we know it's not him.
Right.
You know, this is a very obvious red herring.
Mm-hmm. There's a bar tab up on the wall talking about who was served what. And we learned some names here, Green, Briage, and Blair, you know, folks around. And there is a note on the barkeep. His name is Oscar Boyton. He has an offer. Somebody wants to pay him for smuggling things in his gin barrels. This is another red herring. And he's got these keys. A lot of the puzzles, like a supporting clue, is matching up the shape of keys. Here, it's not as important, but it's, you know, detail. It's chaff.
Yeah, it comes up later.
Yeah. And there's a logbook that says somebody named Willard Wright, who we know from the last case, rented the dandelion room. And the other room is rented by Ash Blair. And that is the forget-me-not room. We can identify them by the embroideries. So the victim here, you know, is not somebody named Maurice. This is actually Willard Wright.
Yes. Yeah. People using pseudonyms in this, like, is tough. They introduced that pretty quickly, and I find that hard. It took me a while to get my head around it.
They do, but it's very funny because it's almost always the most George Glass shit that's ever been.
It's very George Glass, George Cauldron kind of shit. It's real silly.
The pseudonym here is that the murderer is using is a brand of tobacco, which he has in his and it has in his pocket. Yeah,
which we saw in the last thing because that's actually David Gorin.
Yes.
You know, we saw from before. And you can recognize him here. You can just recognize him by his face.
Yeah. Johnny Five Aces looking motherfucker.
Very Johnny Five Aces. Yeah. He's there playing cards. A man named John, who is jealous of somebody buying his wife a drink. Mm-hmm. And they all have bladed weapons on them that could plausibly murder.
It's so many knives.
It's a big knife party.
Yeah. And Gorin has a note outlining these requirements of the trading company that he works for. You know, they have this client who needs to leave the next day and we have to deliver the product with the servant boy to, keep their name spotless. So there are proxies in play.
Yes. No. The fiddler said he'll never gamble something so dear to him again. Mm-hmm. And the flyer on the wall says, like, hear the music from Evans.
Yeah.
So we can find out he's Evans. Like, you always go to hear Evans.
Yeah. He gambled away his watch. So that's why the murder room has a watch that says Maurice on it.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. There's a sheet of paper on the table that has the scores for the different card games here. Mm-hmm. We have to identify everyone, which we do through those clues we had up above.
Yeah.
You know, some of them are very easy. Like Willard Wright is the victim, the dandelion room, but then like the watchman is the guy who's a watchman.
Yeah. You know, he's got his name on his alarm that he spins. Yeah.
Yes.
You know.
The big intuitive leap that I got during this was figuring out roughly when the murder happened and who wasn't playing cards at that time.
Yep. It's so good.
Yeah. Like that's a really fun intuitive leap.
Yeah.
It started out feeling, you know, arbitrary, like, oh, figure out, you know, who was playing these card games at this time. Like, oh, that's just another detail in the scene to have a complete picture. This is just busy work it wants me to do.
Mm-hmm.
But then this is one where the right side of the worksheet tied into the left side of the worksheet.
Very clearly, you know, somebody was playing, they were gone for the middle one and then they came back. And that's what it was. It was David Gorin. What did it? And, you know, tried to frame Redruth, with it. Yeah. I love that, you know, because it kind of seems when you see this big sheet of math, you know, the score sheet or whatever, it's almost like you have to you think that it's trying to make you figure out who won, like, okay, who is ahead or whatever, but like, no, it's not at all. Like literally it's just, you're seeing who was absent at particular times.
What it reminds me of is in old adventure games, where you'd have a maze and in good adventure games, you're not actually doing a maze.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing another kind of puzzle to bypass the maze.
Mm-hmm.
Bad adventure games just make you do the maze.
Right.
You know, or bad old like text adventures.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's a big controversial thing in that, but it has moved it as a design thing to like, no, don't make somebody do the dumb busy work.
Mm-hmm.
It's always there as kind of and that's like a game having that kind of confidence. Like to me, that shows a quality. Yeah. Don't make me do something like that. Like we all know how to do that. It's just putting in the steps. for the most part, this game is not interested in doing that.
No, no.
Yeah. It won a lot of trust for me, I guess, in that. Yeah. Like making that intuitive leap.
Mm-hmm. So that's the mystery solved. It was David Gorin. Mm-hmm. You know, he was sent out in order to kill him and then take the golden idol. Is what it was. And you know, we can conclude he was doing this with and for Edmund Cloudley. We get a cutscene showing this man, you know, in this fancy red ribbon hat and a ruby ring. There have been all kinds of ruby rings on several people so far. That is going mm-hmm. to be an identifying detail that is important. He is asking the barkeep for details about the night when Willard Wright died. So there's some follow-up yes. happening.
Yep. Somebody's on the case.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily that lawman.
Right.
This moves us on to an intoxicating dinner party.
Yep.
Here. Another real classic mystery scenario.
Despite the who was sitting where, which I think is also a little bit of a subversion of mm-hmm. of that kind of puzzle, in that you're not solving what you think you're solving, and it gives a bigger motivation. You know, even with that, this is one of my favorites in this.
Mm-hmm.
I like this a lot because it's the first big expansion of scale. And I love working out the various grudges and predilections of the serving staff.
It's a weird thing. Like I like this one just fine.
Mm-hmm.
This is a weird way to bisect it, but just the way my mind works.
Mm-hmm.
I like the right half of it more than the left half of it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
If that makes sense, like figuring out the conspiracy with the servants
mm-hmm.
was really cool. I think that when you are figuring out the dining thing,
mm-hmm.
like, yes, it is to another purpose, but in the end of the day, you are still just figuring out who was served what by a series of qualities about them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it is, like you're still doing Jindosh Lock shit. Like,
yeah.
Oh, this person can't have a heavy meal. This person has to take a Peptid
mm-hmm.
beforehand. This person can't drink. Like when I start having to have a list of qualities of a person,
yeah,
we're just doing a logic grid.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this doesn't go full into that, but that's when it starts flirting with me. Not liking mm-hmm. it. That's not yeah. not what I want to do.
Yeah.
So this is a mixed grill for me a little bit, but it does introduce us to Little Pip, who is a fucking paralysis demon. Little Pip is so scary. It's a murder moppet.
So much. Yeah.
He's one of the murder moppets. It's fucking Tim Tom and you know it's Tim Tom.
Yeah.
Like
Kid Tim Tom scary. And Kevin. Yeah.
Yeah, Kevin. It's scary. Little Pip.
He sleeps in the half floor above the kitchen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's this little goblin man they have.
Yeah. He sleeps like, on a sack of garbage.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. You have to like leave some of your shavings in the drain or he comes and takes one of your teeth in the night.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Little Pip will extract his dew.
Yeah. He takes his bloody measure. Yeah. So this is four rooms. Mm-hmm. It is a mansion. The murder site is the dining room above the first room,
mm-hmm.
Where a woman named Rose has been poisoned. Her face is all blotchy. She's been poisoned. We know yes. Rose.
Yeah.
We've seen her.
She got the bulk of the inheritance, right? So yep. that establishes a kind of motive here. We've got Edmund and Peter. They're back in play. They're standing alongside the young woman. There's also, so there's a young woman, you know, very pretty. And there's a very old man there as mm-hmm. well. And they're all yelling at the butler. And each of them has different shaped keys on them as well. The butler, I love because, or not the butler, the very old man, with mm-hmm. his, like his wig that looks like a folded towel on top of his yeah. head and his leathery, like, I don't know, like cigar store skin is so good.
He's got that folded towel. So, nobody can track the tracker. They put up his nose.
Yes.
Yeah. So the butler has a note from Peter. He wants the young woman to sit next to him at dinner. Everyone's yeah. trying to get this piece.
Yes. And the table has all these different place settings of meat, salad, wine, and there are two glasses of gray liquid. They're peptic tonic. And one mm-hmm. of the glasses of gray liquid is partially consumed, right? So that is yes. That is information about where the poison was.
Yeah. The entry hall, which has the fewest number of kind of clues and incident, this is where Little Pip lives.
Mm-hmm.
He's going through the coats and he has a note from David telling him to get him a new cigar. Yeah, we know David Gorin. He's a smoker. He likes yep. cigars.
Yeah. So he's not in the scene, but he is, you know, implicated in some of this. There's a woman's coat. So Mary's coat, has two notes in it, you know, that identifies her as Mary Richards. There's another coat, or another note here, Of Edmund inviting her to the dinner. And she's also got another note from Peter Battley. So there is some rivalry here, romantic rivalry, yes, between Edmund and his nephew, and his fail-son nephew.
Yeah. Fail-son nephew sent her a drawing of himself strangling a tiger.
For your
That's
diary.
That's so funny. That is so funny.
Uh-huh. Look at this thing I thought of me doing.
Yeah, that's very good. There is a statue of a woman holding a jug of water that has a syringe hidden in it. The kitchen has two servants, an older, kind of less satisfied one named Lucia. She has a note saying Mary doesn't like meat. So this is where you're starting to get the food.
Correct. Yeah. The quality.
The younger one, Ada, has this strangely, this is the part I like. So I say I like the right side of this. Mm-hmm. Ada has a strangely worded letter about blackmail allegations against her father.
Yeah.
And we get this kind of posting of duties that gives us the last names of the servants and mentions David Gorin may need to come and go at night. So we're figuring out whose manor this is and that David Gorin lives here as well, who has been a player in almost all of the scenes so far.
Yeah. I really like figuring out who lives in which rooms, right? Because it's immersive sim stuff, right? It's doing personal archaeology. You know, like Brian the Butler, he's been there the longest, but he's got a bunch of anti-nobility propaganda. And we can link that to him because on the Butler's person, when you inspect him, he is like verbally reminding himself of this parable about a nobleman who embarrasses himself, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. David Gorin has a big bag full of key blanks. And a cabinet full of weapons, the mountebank. Mm-hmm. Little Pip has this tiny little mouse hole with a mattress in it with some stuff. Key blanks, this vial of amber liquid, and pulp cereals there. Including these pulp cereals about Monkey Man versus Dark Hand.
Yeah.
There. Mm-hmm. That will make more sense. Dark Hand is a title.
Yes. Lucia, the older... the older servant, she has this, her room has a love potion, and a racy novel in it. The detail that helps us get here, Ada is like jabbing her about her racy novels in conversation. And she tries to pretend that she's not reading smut.
Yes. She has a note here. It says, remember the fourth one from every row. And this is, if you do this in there, we correlate that with her letter. The code is use substance to remove target. Sincerely, Dark Hand Steward.
Yeah.
This is how we find the secret code book in her study. You also see the little outside of her window, the little,
it's the bag.
The bag that it was transported up with.
Yeah. So it looks like the bag is, the bag of key blanks is associated with David Gorin because he's no good. Right. But actually it is hanging from a rope that leads from Ada's room. So like she's the one who has these key blanks to get around the mansion and get into stuff, including this study safe that has the bottles of Peptic Tonic. She had access to it.
Yep. And you can tell by taking the shape of the keys and the locks here. This is a blue square lock.
Yeah.
Belongs to Edmund who has the house. So we're figuring out who has access to the poison and stuff. The desk in the study has letters from Rose about Peter constantly asking for money. Again, any opportunity to kick Peter. she's conspiring with Edmund to get him to go to the colonies.
Right.
Get him out of here.
Right. She's come back to the Imperial core. She wants to live in her luxury. She doesn't want this guy, freeloading off of her. The wall safe has the golden idol in it. So, you know, Edmund's gotten a hold of it. That's who Gorin was getting this for. David Gorin was getting it for. And the waste paper basket has just just confetti of the murderer's row of people who would want to kill, Edmund specifically. There's one from this Brotherhood of Masks. There's one from a parliamentary rival, George Bridges, and one from this populist group called the Final Vanguard. And then finally, there's a note from him telling Peter to stay away, or there's a note from Peter telling Edmund to stay away from Mary. So any number of these people would want to kill him, but he is not the person who ended up dead.
Yes. Yeah. By process of elimination, we also can find out Mary's elderly father here, Lothar Richards.
God, Lothar is a great name. Yeah.
Lothar of the hill people. So then you do the who sat where there. The implications for, again, how this works out, I like. Because this is teaching you that intent doesn't equal result, in this. Because the murder victim was killed accidentally.
Yes.
Here. Rose was poisoned accidentally. They're trying to kill someone else.
Yeah.
But you're also just doing the Mary has no meat, but Peter is next to Mary. Lothar has a cigar. Like you're doing Jindosh Lock stuff, which I don't like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, so like that is the leap that you have to take. Rose was not the intended person to be killed, but she was sitting right next to Edmund, who was. Yes. And he swapped. Their little glasses of tonic.
Yeah. So we find out, you know, Darkhand Steward, we'll find out what that means, wanted Edmund Cloudsley dead. We can find this out from the note in the trash. And Ada having the encoded note from the assassin there. Looks like the butler would have done it because he hates his boss and he has a key, but it was Ada.
Yes.
Who did it. She also had the means. Edmund must have known about the plot and switched the tonics.
Yeah.
There.
So, dastardly.
Yeah. All under the mind control of little Pip.
He's pulling the strings.
Yeah. He's actually the star of both DLCs, Pip Chronicles. One of them's a locked room mystery where he's a sperm and he has to get out of a ball. It's a whole escape room. The
Pip Rising.
Yeah. Pip Rising. Yeah. Bad enough dude to get past a vasectomy. only Pip can do it.
Yeah. Onto another very good case.
Yeah, this is
good. The explosive events in the forest cabin. I fucking love this.
Yeah, this is a good one. So there's a murder in the back room of this cabin where two men and the idol are caught in an explosion.
Yep.
That is happening here. This is the most Oberdin something looks like with the explosion happening in mid-time.
Yeah, two people suspended midair. Yeah.
Yeah. The wagon outside has a registry of henchmen. That's very funny to me, with vague description of their skills, diagram, and a diagram of hats.
Yeah.
The diagram of hats is one of the, for me, one of the more perplexing red herrings in this. Like, I understand where it fits into the thing. It keeps showing up and not necessarily being very useful for a while.
Yeah.
It really threw me off.
It seems like it's going to be an identifying key for like picking out multiple people. It's really just about one guy. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one guy who likes hats.
Yeah.
In the front room, David Gorin is knocked out with a head wound. This is where you start getting weird omniscient information you wouldn't get just from looking. When you check him, it says he's still breathing.
Yes.
Like, it looks like he's dead at first.
Right.
Collapsed over a coffin. The coffin has a scarecrow in it. And he has notes about retrieving a fresh corpse from the workhouse for Edmund.
Yeah.
You know, reanimator stuff.
Yeah. Lucia is here, the loyal cook who probably you know, came to the cabin with her master. She has this flyer, a wanted poster for this dashing gentleman thief named Walter Keane. He always wears a new hat in the most recent style. We can see him, like, he's done up like a Lone Ranger kind of guy. At the doorway to the room with the explosion.
He looks like Phantom Limb's dad.
Yeah.
There's a note on the wall that has everyone's duties outlined, so we can see that. If you go in the back room, it looks like Keane and his men kicked in the door, so the latch is busted from the outside there. And the details on the men being blown apart correspond to that registry of henchmen.
Yeah.
So we can tell that there are two henchmen.
Right.
The most perplexing, you know, little clue here, enticing clue here, is on the shelf there's a rotten apple and a green apple.
Yeah.
And the idol has two symbols dialed in.
Right.
And a small weight attached to the lever. This isn't quite, you know, a red herring. We're going to find out the idol did fuck with these apples, but it's not the most recent thing it did.
Yeah. Somebody having in their possession one apple that is more rotten than the other is not necessarily mind-blowing information.
Fruit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's just what happens when you own fruit. As a fruit owner, I can attest
to that. La-dee-da.
Yeah. I've thought about giving it up. I like it and it's good for you. The mind games you had to play, the game of Yomi you had to play with fruit is so frustrating. I had to throw out almost an entire bunch of bananas because they all went rotten basically at once. Like they had conspired. I don't know why. And I don't know how exactly, but the skin got all thin and weird. They were like, everything's getting worse. Food is getting worse.
Can't you see none of us want to go on? when I buy a bag of oranges, I basically have to keep them separated. Like they're going to testify against each other. Because when you put two
put them all in sequester.
Yeah. Because if you keep oranges together, like in a bowl, they're going to go rotten so fast.
They speed run dying to get back at you. I also like the absolute timing, like game of irritating stick timing that you have to play to eat an avocado of like a 15 minute window.
Yeah.
I have for this avocado. It's all just a fucking joke.
Yeah. I mean, the real secret is frozen fruit, but
But if you're making smoothies and stuff,
oh yeah.
What if I'm eating like a banana, I don't want to just thaw out a bunch of bananas to eat.
Yeah.
You know, that's weird.
That is weird. That's maniac behavior.
That's super maniac behavior. Frozen fruit's great for smoothies, but only for smoothies.
Yeah.
Anywho, murder.
Murder.
The Edmund is hiding in a chest. Yeah. He's covering his ears, and he has this notebook with a symbol combinations and observed effects.
Right.
So we're learning these things that potentially the idol can do.
Right.
Here.
Like it can create a vacuum. It can filter gold out of larger bodies of water, right? And this is where we also get the spontaneous combustion and the freezing. And there's one, this is still a work in progress, that mentions a mysterious but potentially very meaningful effect related to the fruit. Yes. And from looking at this, we can discern what's going on with this idol and what it does, just based on the order of operations for how things need to be dialed in. So we, you have to cast a freezing spell in order to catch something on fire. What it is doing is it is taking a property from one thing and transferring it to the other. So by freezing something, you are actually absorbing the heat from it and then imparting it onto something else. Right?
When I talk about different kinds of puzzles this game contains, we're getting into mist territory,
like
figuring out technology, figuring out how a doodad works.
And I'm over here rubbing my hands.
Yeah, this is very cool bait.
Yeah.
That specifically. I like it too. Like, I think that's a really cool, and it's a super cool idea for a mystical object.
Oh, the way it goes.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, what they ultimately use it for is my favorite part of this game.
Yeah.
Like all the deduction and puzzle stuff's great, you know, but just the flavor of this bizarre system of rules is very Gary.
Yep.
It's neat. Mm-hmm. So what ended up happening here, what we find out, Edmund had David Gorin use his connection to try to get a corpse. He's trying to do something with the corpse. Walder Keen took a job to rob him. And we know, that we don't find out who he is hired by here.
Yeah.
But we can find that out. We know that from last time. We know who has motive. You keep that, where this having a chronological series of events helps you.
Yes.
David Gorin brought the coffin. And then these thugs, Hardy Abe, clubbed him there. And Edmund ended up killing the robbers by increasing the amount of air in a sealed vessel to create this explosion.
Right. We know that he did this intentionally because he knows there's going to be a bang. He was in that chest and he's covering his ears. He's got a little shitty giggle on his face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We get a little cutscene after this where David Gorin is talking to the coroner saying, it was a chemical explosion. It disfigured and killed Edmund as well.
Yeah.
I really like this line as well. I mean, we know David Gorin is a piece of shit, but having him lie about two different things in one sentence is your clue that the second part's a lie as well.
Yes.
You know, we don't see this explosion as it happens. We have him with his little giggly shit thing, but we don't see the end of the explosion.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, it's possible that Edmund could have died.
Mm-hmm.
In this explosion after the scene we see.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons why you think that it didn't happen is because David Gorin said it did.
Right.
You know, if that makes sense.
It's established that he is not trustworthy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he's motivated.
Yeah.
This brings us into chapter 3, The Ascent.
And the chapter, or the mystery, the strange practices of a secretive society, and it feels like there's a break here, and we're seeing where the idol is ending up. The murder scene is in this underground bunker compound for a cult for the secret society. A person in this ghoul mask has fallen over dead in the middle of this ritual, with a bunch of people in disguises standing around him.
Yeah. Outside, there's a man with a hand and an eye tattoo. He's been stripped, bound, and gagged. So David Gorin, on orders from Walter Keen, we see this on a note, ambushed this guy and took his uniform.
Yeah.
So somebody's infiltrated this cult.
Yeah, we've got a David Gorin in full disguise, knocking about somewhere in there.
In many ways, this is David Gorin's game.
Kinda, yeah.
He's the most active participant in any of this stuff.
Really. inside, we start seeing a bunch of the cult symbology. and putting things together. So there are these tapestries that show the symbols for the different houses of the Brotherhood. We have the Dark Hands, symbolized by a dark hand, Proud Beasts, who are symbolized by lions, and the Water Snakes, symbolized by a snake. And each of these houses has ranks, indicated by the number of eyes on them. So initiate, steward, and master, 1 to 3 eyes.
Yeah, and that's familiar, Dark Hand Steward.
Yeah.
You know, we saw that before. Not just the name, it's a rank. So there's three scrolls on the table and they tell this story. Walter Keane lying about this job, you know, going to kill Edmund and get the idol, retrieve the idol for the Brotherhood, going with David's lie about Edmund being killed. This is, I find this was hard to intuit.
Don't feel bad about that. It took me until the very end of the game to realize this when I played it the first time.
This is hard, I think.
But it's such a cool detail that
it's a super cool detail.
Just this new guy who pops up.
Yes. It was really confusing to me, like very confusing to me.
Yeah.
And he linked up with this arcanist named Lazarus Hurst as vouching for him to join the Brotherhood. The reveal of who this is very cool. I was so fucking confused about this. I like, it's hard for me to overstate how much this threw me.
It's
this
also
when I talk about taking those breaks, like I did get to this. I was like, okay, this is too many things for me to keep track of and too many characters. I'm going to put this down for a couple days. Like,
It's also a little humiliating looking at it in hindsight because it is so clear. And the fact that his name is fucking Lazarus.
That part is, I figured that out before I figured out that Walter Keane got recruited.
Yes.
Like, which was just, I don't know what, that wasn't intuitive to me.
Yeah.
So, the final letter we find, there's a guy named Sir Geoffrey Sinclair who objects to Lazarus joining because Walter Keane is a liar and a thief. You didn't hire him to be a thief.
This lower chamber has a guy in this big red hairy mask who's about to brand this initiate who must be Lazarus, inducting him as a Proud Beast initiate.
There's a scroll around the statue's neck that talks about the cult rites, this inception, evaluation, transition, and admission, along with the houses and ranks that administer them. There's a ritual room upstairs with a ritual room to the side with scrolls on the wall that outline the different challenge rituals that you have to do. And they're doing a classic poison chalice thing. With the defender who is from being challenged choosing first.
This very same ritual is called different things. I like this squabble, conflict, dispute, and discord, depending on who is involved. Each of these also calls for different decorations. So we've got to figure out precisely what rite each of these people is going through. So Lazarus downstairs, we have to look at these objects on pedestals and then correlate that with these hanging scrolls to figure out precisely what rite this is, so we can know who is the person branding him to make it clear what each mask and what each robe correlates to. Masks are houses and the robes are rank.
We're not actually identifying people in this one. Them having the squabble, conflict, dispute, and discord. Lazarus Hurst, say what you will about him, but he did make this cult much cooler. This fucking dorky, you know.
This is the ritual of the swollen ass.
It's dorkier than that. It's just like the, you know, the stiff tip.
The unblinking eye.
The second thing you need to figure out is which poison ritual is being done of those. So the decorations, you know, are the key. This gets a little into logic grid stuff. Like when we have this kind of ritual, we have these kind of things up. And when we have this kind of ritual, this kind of person does it. You know, so there's a Grim Reaper in the window. There's a big book on the table. This is the ritual of dispute.
And we figure out what's going on. Just by correlating and figuring out who is doing what. The victim of this, the person who chose poorly, is Geoffrey Sinclair, the person who was challenging Walter Keane over this induction, right? And like the thing that we have to answer is figuring out where David Gorin is, like which one he is disguised as, and exactly how he signaled to Walter which chalice to pick, right? And it's the hand that he is holding this pitcher in.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. We go to then to my other favorite one of these, the crowning celebration by the lighthouse.
Mm-hmm.
This is super cool.
Yeah.
A small mystery, three screens, but two of the screens only kind of matter.
Yeah.
To this, we're kind of back to our constrained space
mm-hmm.
for a little bit. But this is where the cool shit starts happening, I think, with the idol.
Yes.
The real cool shit.
Yeah.
This is a ritual. Everyone is unmasked. And there's a dead body behind the lighthouse.
Yeah.
The body died of a fall, but there are lots of red herrings here.
Yeah.
All his bones are broken, and he has a note saying somebody's like, I will summon a demon to break all your bones.
Yeah.
He has this broken horn, this kind of funnel here, that is broken off from something.
Yeah.
And we're going to find out the other piece of this, which is the scepter that has the golden idol in it.
Yes. Concealed inside. There's a chest on this dinghy that they use to row out to this comically small lighthouse island with rules and history, learning what's going on here. So the rules, someone who claims to be the Griffin Reborn, kind of this messianic figure for the cult, has to perform this ritual that cannot be replicated, just by the magic that this cult knows.
Yes.
If the miracle is repeated, the person claiming to be the Griffin Reborn gets killed.
Yeah. And the cult doesn't know magic.
No, not at all.
There's no magic in this game, actually. It's technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's layer told. But the idea here is just like somebody has to do something and they can't repeat it. So it can't be trickery.
Yes. You know?
And we get this history where we show people have tried all mm-hmm. these things. And this guy, this badass named Angus McBain, who has disproved all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's the skeptic's guide to the universe of this universe, who is going through disproving. So we figure out by context, he is the guy who goes through and challenges all these miracles.
Right.
Lazarus Hurst has demonstrated a miracle to become the Griffin Reborn.
Yeah.
You know, and his notebook talks about pointing his cane, you know, which we see the idol inside,
mm-hmm.
At the sky to absorb air and then using it to control his descent.
Yeah.
He's done a levitation.
Mm-hmm.
Trick.
And it's very tricky. Like in the notebook, it talks about like, you really have to know how to control this thing. So it doesn't slip out from under you and you know, you
yes.
fall uncontrollably. Right.
Oh.
And that is what the victim here, the person who died, Angus, didn't know how to do.
Yes. Yep. There is a letter, that, you know, so Walter Keane has this staff with the rest of the idol in it. There's a letter that was sent to Angus McBain, giving him kind of bad information. On how to replicate this miracle.
They're
giving him false. Nobody else thought of doing that.
Nope.
Throughout history.
Yeah.
The letter about the ceremony, we had the lawyer, Nicholas Maker, which we haven't seen
mm-hmm.
since early chapters, but he's been about. He's a member of the Brotherhood. And we got hinted with that ruby ring.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned the names of new people.
Yes.
These two masters here. James right. Turner, the Dark Hand and director of the Seven Seas Trading Company, and Alistair Cock, a general and gifted coxman.
I think Coke. Or Koch? Yeah.
Koch.
Okay. Alistair Koch.
Dick.
Yes.
Alistair Dick.
Balls.
Alistair Balls. John Porno.
Yeah. So it's pretty clear what happened here. You know, Lazarus has gotten himself crowned as the master of this cult. Did through subterfuge, leading to the death of this Angus McBain character.
This is where I put together the transferring properties
mm-hmm.
element of the idol.
Mm-hmm.
And that made a lot of the story seem super cool to me because
yes.
that is a cool thing for it to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
It is limited. It's not just an all powerful MacGuffin.
Right.
It's got detail.
Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah. Then we get to a case that I think is a little bit too big. This one was pretty tough.
A little too big, a little racist.
Yeah.
Like the Lemurians aren't real.
No.
You know, and this, they are in this world. Like that mm-hmm. was a famous like Mu or Atlantis.
Yeah,
you know, kind of fake lost civilization,
mm-hmm.
but they definitely have a guy here mm-hmm. who plays in some racist stereotypes.
Yeah,
of this, I don't care for.
Yeah, so this takes place at this country estate, where we've got this guy who has been stabbed in his forehead in this library,
yes.
and this bloody boomerang lying nearby is this is the murder weapon, and there are tons of people.
Yes.
And we can look at them, but also we can look at these broader places around the estate. So like these different stations where people were at the time, at the time the murder took place.
Yes. The dead man has a letter from Dr. James Turner inviting him to come to debate the prime minister situation with Leopold.
Right.
And there is a wall of Lemurian weapons. Like, even in a video game, the British Empire is just taking things from other countries and putting mm-hmm. them on walls.
Yeah.
The missing boomerang is there as well. And there's a codex of all the different Lemurian clans.
Right.
That we have here. It's also, it's not important that it was a boomerang.
Nope.
Like, I was just like, oh, he threw the boomerang and it stabbed himself in the head. Uh-huh. That's what boomerangs do. And I know that's not real, but like, come on. Be cool. It does not happen.
Yeah.
We also get into this thing about drugs. They have a poster on the wall that tells you the effects of different psychoactive plants.
Mm-hmm.
What they do. So like the black poppy knocks you out and leaves you with pink eyes. Two people have pink eyes here, Leopold and the butler. And then Lemurian lichen makes you blink a lot.
Yeah.
And there's a blue-haired guy who has weird testimony when we get to the testimonies, and he's blinking constantly.
Yes. The rate of blinking was hard. Was hard to get here. Just because, you know, the pink eyes are very obvious. And I thought that I was done with figuring out who got drugged. I didn't know that there were going to be two substances in play based on this poster. Yeah.
I agree. I think this is basically, for me, the pivot point where this is more complicated than I want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the stuff that happens from here on from a plot perspective is stuff I like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is just more moving parts than I'm really interested in a puzzle. And that's not a criticism. It's just my preference.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to keep track of this many things.
Yeah. I don't know. It might also be just like a matter of flavor too. Like, I like this a little bit less than the final case, the one that spans, you know, basically the whole countryside. Primarily because this is like an Agatha Christie whodunit kind of thing.
Yeah.
Rather than figuring out a bunch of smaller scenes that contribute to a larger timeline. Yeah.
The last one is also, do you understand what happened?
Yes.
In the game. And there's always a lot of value to that, I think. Like, the just the final, you know, do you get it?
Yeah.
This one, and a little bit to me also the next one, has a little bit of like, okay, you know, is you big. You're doing big. It's big. I get you. There's a lot of verbs. You know, when I would look down and see that like 42 clues to unlock, this is arguably too many clues.
Yeah.
You know, I got a little bit of that. Like, my least favorite, one of the reasons why I'm not a puzzle, like, I don't consider myself to be a hardcore puzzle guy, is that one of my most frequent emotions when playing a puzzle game is exhaustion.
Yeah.
And it comes not when I'm really playing, but when I look down and see the scope of something. Like, I look down and see 42 clues and I'm like, oh, you know, and I it's hard for me to shake that off. It's what made me stop playing Baba Is You.
Yeah.
A game that I love the first half of and would like to cover just the first half of for the show.
If we could. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you get near the second half of it and it's like, Jesus fucking Christ. Like, this is just going to go on forever.
Yeah.
You know, it's very demoralizing for Gary's.
Yeah. I get that. I get that feeling too. I just think I get it at a different spot. I also, like, depending on how much executive function I have that day, I am more or less able to break the big thing down into a bunch of small things. You know,
it's just
a matter of personal taste and tolerances kind of stuff.
It's 100% not a criticism. It's just. And then also some people, I think, really thrive on that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they get that, you know, they're like, oh man, there's 42 clues.
Oh, I'm going to prove this wrong. Yeah.
You know, and I just don't have that in me. That's dead in me, you know? So it's if you ever wonder why we don't do more, why we haven't covered like Steven's sausage roll, it's because at one point there's going to be a really big island with like, 30 steps.
It's also not an interesting kind of puzzle to me. This is cool to me. Yeah.
And hard to, can you imagine talking about it?
Oh yeah.
No. Like, then you move left and then you have to flip it right. But then when you do that, you're actually pushing back at the same time.
Uh-huh. It's all spatial stuff and it's hard to describe the eureka moments.
It'd be describing solving a puzzle box.
Yeah.
You know,
like, interesting to do, but like, we're here for like the narrative of, you know, talking about the experience.
We're here for
it.
Both.
Yeah.
Like, we want to have, and the best games have both.
Yeah.
You know, it's also why we haven't done Picross.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, what would we say?
As much as I fucking love Picross and play every one of those games that comes out, you know,
like, what, just, how do you talk about them? Like, they're it's like talking about crossword puzzles.
Yeah.
Or Sudoku.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we get Urkel. These drug effects. Sorry. Like Urkel. James Turner is yelling at Leopold that he is the killer.
Yeah.
Trying to frame this boy named Patu.
Mm-hmm.
He's missing a button on his jacket and the victim is holding the button. So he considers this to be a smoking gun.
Right.
Leopold's letter from James identifies the victim as Augustus.
Right. Augustus, this other person, a leader of another party who is in contention to become the prime minister. Right.
Yeah. Alistair Balls joins James, accusing Leopold of being
an Aquitanian agent. This
Aquitanian agent.
Yes, this world's version of France. That's what this is.
Conflict between Albion, which is this England, and Lemuria, the legendary continent that is real in this timeline.
Yes. Yeah. You know, sent here to provoke this conflict. So this Lemurian prince, Urgen Patu, he has this letter on him saying that he should, you know, take the invitation to go to the house, even though he hates these people, in order to reclaim the honor of the Lemurians, giving him motive. Right. Mm-hmm. And he is saying, when we inspect him, that he hopes nobody noticed him kneeling over the man with the eye patch when he was unconscious. Leopold is the man with the eye patch.
Yeah. Outside by the fountain, there's a newspaper article about the split election results. The New Order Party, led by Lazarus Hearst, who we know, has the most MPs, but the Loyalists and moderates will form a coalition. Which is a thing that can happen in governments without our shitty system.
Yeah.
Augustus and Leopold are both vying for prime ministership.
Yeah. So it'd be super valuable to the New Order Party, not an ominous name, if they were thrown into disarray, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
So the constable who has come to investigate this has this big book of everyone's testimony. This also is very much, like a logic grid kind of deal, like spot the contradiction. If I don't mind like doing this and figuring it out, but when it is laid out as just a bunch of documents that you have to reconcile, it's a little bit too like law clerky for me.
Cause you can't have them. The line is, and I know that this is me being the outlier on this, but it's having to take notes. Because right. You can't have these things simultaneously. Like if this were a paper game where I could lay these all out and look at them at the same time, that would be one thing. But if I'm clicking and just pulling them up one after another, I have to start making notes of those logic grid properties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ways that they're connected. Yeah. It's a mark against playing this on the Switch, honestly.
100%. Like this is the point in which I started having to play this sitting at my computer, but not playing it on my computer.
Yeah.
Which is, again, not really a criticism of the game. It's a criticism of the form factor, but it still bummed me out a little bit.
Yeah. So the information for this helps to identify everybody and also establishes the location of everybody when Leopold's body was found, right?
Yep. That testimony that Leopold has determined that James was the one who drugged him with Poppy in the morning, knocked him out. James stole the button off of Leopold's jacket. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he has the means and motive for this.
Yeah.
This middle paragraph we have to do is a little bit trickier. Leopold saw Elgin when he was fading out. Mm-hmm. But Gideon says that Elgin was with him the whole time.
Right.
However, Elgin drugged Gideon.
Yeah.
And left to steal back a Lemurian seal. That was the honor.
Yeah, we can see
he's getting back.
Yeah, we can see that that one of these is missing on the wall. And it is on Elgin's person. So there is that. Gideon is very funny. You know, this blue haired socialite kind of guy, you know, he was drinking tea with Elgin, saw Alistair, leave the chess house and then return around the time the body was found. So this is Alistair and James working in concert with each other. This makes him the likeliest murderer.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. After you saw this little cutscene, Lazarus brings Alistair and James into his trust, demonstrating the effects of the idol.
Right.
He got this from Keen. Mm-hmm. He takes the heat from a glass of water, freezing it, and deploys it onto some straw, burning it.
Yes.
This is because it's important for you to understand that if you don't understand what the idol does at this point, it'll be very hard to do the next couple chapters. So they have to lay it out.
Yeah. The taking and the giving in this chapter four, the final one here, the new order, with this case, the triumph of order. I really like this. I didn't expect to, just because it is so mathy, but that math is connected to really cool stuff. This new society that has popped up.
The new society stuff is great to me. And the math is small enough numbers that it's very intuitive to me. Yes. Like I did not have to break out a piece of paper and pencil, which is good to me.
Yeah.
The scope of this is still a little bigger than I want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is similar to me to the dinner party one where there's like half of this I like.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot. Figuring out what the different bylaws are, how many infractions there were, and what it cost you was all cool to me. Yeah. The rest of the stuff I was less into.
Right.
In this chapter or this puzzle rather. Yeah. So we see a very old man being hauled away from some judges at some kind of court,
right?
Under this banner of a winged heart with an eye superimposed on the sun.
Yeah. Super cool. The old man's body has this poem on it, The Prince of Dusk. No idea who this is. And figuring out who it is, and it is somebody familiar to us, is, you know, kind of the key of this. Yes. So the record keeper, who is, you know, seems most central here, that's Nicholas Maker. It's the lawyer.
who read
the will. And he's talking to himself. He says, I would be happy about order prevailing if it didn't go against the first virtue. And you look at him, and you look at everybody around, everybody kind of has this passport, labeling their balance of merit along with these kind of this bullet pointed list of infractions and virtues that they have demonstrated.
Yes. David Gorin looks on in the centurion helmet, and he says something very important to figuring out what happened here. He's never seen so much merit removed in a tribunal.
Right.
Here. This is where it all comes together. Mm-hmm. Up above, James and Alistair look down on the proceedings. Lazarus is in a side room teaching children the four virtues.
Right. Seems like he's teaching them the four virtues. What he's actually doing is fucked up and cool.
Yeah, exactly. Very good.
Yeah.
Lazarus's space here has merit books for the several people being judged. They're kind of logs here. Walter Keane was ejected from the party for betraying Lazarus. Mm-hmm. Lothar Richards gained merit for revealing the whereabouts of Mary and her husband, Peter Batley.
Yeah.
That's not really a meritous thing.
Nope.
That's what Lazarus wants to do because him horny.
Uh-huh. Him horny. Him very
horny. You ever get so down bad that you manipulate a cursed idol to upset the natural order? You know, it's the horniest you can be.
We've all been there.
The string of emojis that you sexed to indicate this is very complicated, and that's going to be mostly what the sequel is about, since it takes place in the 70s.
When they had emojis.
Yeah, well, they had to make them with little strips of paper, but they'd pass them around on tiny little sheets to do coke off of, and Studio 54. Except in this universe, it's Studio 45.
So we can look at Lazarus and see that he is using the golden idol to take, quote, merit from the kids. And something very important here is that little Pip, the hated little Pip, is here physically unchanged, even though time has passed.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the kids has a newspaper article about how the New Order Party has attained total control of Parliament. But the kind won't recognize the king won't recognize them, and the party's going to march on the castle within 2 months.
Yeah,
take them out. There are lock boxes that match the colors of the virtue poster, the different virtues, each contain items confiscated in the name of those virtues.
Yeah,
figuring out what the virtues are is the main puzzle of that.
Yes. It is one of the big and cool things that you do. And there are also like propaganda posters around showing stuff as well. And you got to look at this unspoken lines on these symbols to figure out what is valued here. So the first virtue is moderation. You don't want to show excessive emotion, any kind of indulgence. You can see from the confiscated drugs and alcohol, or any kind of lust is considered an infraction on this.
Yeah. Diligence. So there's a poster of a pig sleeping at work. this is based on, you know, finding this mistaken invoice in this box. So making a mistake, sloth, mistakes, untidiness, generally.
Yeah. Particularly at work. The third one is beauty. Any infractions against the aesthetics of the new order, any kind of frivolity is punished. So like the box there has a ton of art. There's instruments in there. There's also a picture of Gideon and his hair. So ridiculous fashion is considered an infraction here. Yeah.
And then truth. So we're getting into 1984 shit because this includes books.
Yes.
You know, books just, you know, fiction being a big pack of lies. That is a thing that religions have sincerely thought.
Yes.
Several times throughout history and governments. Mm-hmm. People talking about lying and secrets.
Yeah.
Being a breach of the fourth virtue. Mm-hmm. So now we have to determine how much each infraction cost.
Right.
And we do this by looking at their little merit passports and doing algebra, solving for X. But luckily, every figure is below 10.
Right.
This is all math you can do in your head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like figuring out what moderation costs You know, James Turner has both a moderation and a truth infraction, which is easy enough to figure out. Moderation gets the biggest merit deduction. Every infraction is -7.
Yes.
Diligence, like Nicholas Maker has 2 diligence infractions, so it's super easy. Like, that's a key for the rest. Each is -3.
Yep. Beauty is -2. We find this out from Alistair having a moderation and a beauty one. And then truth, David Gorin has 2 truth infractions for -1. Then you look at the merit books of everybody judged today to determine what their total merit score was.
Yeah.
And this is just, you know, categorizing them, putting it together. It's just kind of the busy work.
Yeah.
Again, it ends up equaling out to a cool thing. Which is that, you know, Walter gets dinged for wearing these hats and stuff, but Gideon loses 70 for crying while being interviewed and punished for this.
Yeah. So you cried while we were beating you up. So, and he cried 10 times. So lost 70 merit, whatever that is.
Well, we're going to find out, and it's incredible.
Yeah. But Lothar, he gained points on average by selling out his daughter. And, you know, the pettiest of all, this count gained 200 merit for donating his castle to the party.
Yes.
So, you know, just really picayune, you know, petty stuff here is getting getting people a ton of favor. In addition to the hypocrisy, you know, Lazarus has breached all of these. Right.
Yeah. And the thing in the margins that you're figuring out from this is that the demerits and virtues, what you're gaining and losing are years of your life.
Yes.
Those are being taken from you and for doing things by the idol and given to you for doing things by the idol. We're getting that's already a premise. You know, that's
in
fucking
time.
Rad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In time. Yeah, like that is a, I mean, I don't mean like it's a copy off. I mean, that is a cool enough premise.
Yes.
To sell an entire work on its own. I think.
Yeah.
You know, having power over the only thing that matters in life, you know, donating a castle and living for 200 extra years. It's also resonant in terms of being kind of real. You know, the more you have, not the more virtuous you are, because these are fake virtues.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but the more, like, if you donate a castle, if you do, if you're very wealthy, you do live longer.
Yeah.
You know, in real life.
More money equals better than prosperity equals longevity. Yeah.
Yeah. It is, you know, the scene with Lazarus taking youth from the children.
Yep.
through there is literally what the wealthy do.
And they're also being used as youth banks, right? Because, because, you know, like it needs to be taken from them. And also it needs, you know, when somebody is punished, it needs to go somewhere. That's how you get an ageless little pip.
Yeah. A everlasting super pip. Yeah. Really fucking cool.
Yeah.
And that's how Gideon died. He was crying while being punished, and he aged 88 years at once. The largest merit deduction in history.
Yeah.
Yeah. Clapping like a seal. Figuring this out way into it.
Yeah. So it wasn't an old man who was killed. That is somebody who we know who is unrecognizable because he was rendered basically a desiccated corpse by the, by the process through the idol.
The horrid wilting spell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really, really fucking cool.
Yeah.
Love that. Again, like, I don't like this last case very much. It is too big for me. I like what happened.
Yes.
And it's going into Big Lebowski style, you know, Coen Brothers, like all of this mysticalism and far reaching mystery, all just for the love of pussy and an accident, you know, that fucks it up.
And a sum of money under $40,000.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Like, I like that about it. It's just too big. It's the entire region, a bunch of sub scenes. You can go back to every other event. In the thing, like it's just more than I want. This is called A Slight Delay in the Peaceful March to the King's Castle.
Yeah. So this is an attempted insurrection. You know, it's called a peaceful march, but like there's an army camp, which is probably the place where you're going to start out. The party has this camp where we see Nicholas talking about, you know, James and Alistair being missing. They went on this search for Lazarus, who is, you know, not turned up.
Yes. Yeah. The tent has the safe with a note in it. From Walter, you took 32 things from me, blackmailing Lazarus to get them back, threatening to reveal his origins.
Yeah.
Meet him at the place where Willard Wright died. So it's tying in all the old story stuff as well.
Yeah. A lot of these, you know, a couple of these scenes, at least 3 of them are the places you can go on this big map are places where previous murders have taken place.
Yes. Yeah. Nearby, a woman has a logbook of people who passed by. Alistair is trying to get the idol to work on an apple, but it won't work.
Yeah.
It is warped and broken.
Yeah. Busted up. There's a crossroads where this man in a helmet is lying dead. We can't see his face. He's been slashed across the chest. Yep. And we can go to the cabin where the explosion happened and see an aged Walter Keene who is naked for some reason, ambushing somebody. He's got a musket. He has shot somebody in a helmet through the back of the head. While he was distracted by this scarecrow. And it's important. We have dialogue here that talks about him falling for the same trick. So the person who was shot, that's David Gorin. Walter Keene got his revenge.
Yeah, the scarecrow from the cabin explosion murder there. There's a manor with three charred bodies out in front of a cannon here, and a carriage is just visible through the window.
Yeah.
There. Out on Lover's Island, Peter Battley, Mary are having a picnic. Lazarus's horse runs by in the background. And Mary's book has a letter from Edmund written after his death, declaring that he will marry her.
Right.
That's weird. These are all clues that lead to the big twist. Peter has been drunk since early that morning.
Right.
Peter remains a piece of shit the entire time.
But also like a piece of shit in a way that doesn't really affect anybody else.
He kind of Forrest Gumps it. He kind of just stumbles into being there and winning, you know.
So we go to the inn. This is where Ada ended up. She's got this note from Walter, detailing her intended role in this deception of Lazarus at the cabin. She didn't do it. She just kind of hid out here because there's a fucking insurrection happening.
Yeah. Stay home. Yeah. So we know what happened where we need to figure out the order that it happened. There's morning, noon, and afternoon. I think it's morning, late morning and noon. It's something like that. So the scene is at 12:15. That's when we start. And we can find this out from the washerwoman's watch.
That washerwoman keeping track of everything is the absolute key to this. Her logbook. Like, you've got to pay attention to her. Yeah.
That felt a little artificial to me that there's a washerwoman keeping track of this stuff to me. Yeah. Again, part of the reason why this felt a little inelegant to me. Mm-hmm. So a carriage passed by at 8, ended up by the manor. A bike passed by at 8:15. No time to wash if you're just writing down everything that passes by.
Yeah.
maniac. ended up at the cabin, and two people on horseback at 10:15, which is Alistair and James searching for Lazarus.
Yeah. So we know from notes, Lazarus had this meeting at the manor early in the morning. And we've got to take this leap. Peter has been drinking since morning and seems to be celebrating something. Those charred bodies, one of them was Lazarus. He came here to kidnap Mary, and Peter shot him with a fucking cannon.
He won a cannon in a bet. We find out he won a cannon in poker.
Yep.
The way you do. Alistair and James went out to look, before noon for Lazarus. Mm-hmm. They found the idol, and Alistair killed James to keep it for himself, not knowing that it was already broken from the cannon.
Yeah.
There. Yeah.
Walter's blackmail note to Ada places the cabin meeting at 11:30. And we know that Walter Keene killed David Gorin at the cabin. And it must have happened recently because though he's been shot, David Gorin is still breathing.
Yes. Yep. Alistair and James fought over the idol, as presumed, along with David and Walter's deception of each other at the cabin.
Yeah.
And we get an ending cutscene of this party dying. Drink down with the virtues.
I love down with virtues.
Yes, down with virtues is very good. Yeah. Nicholas lies about being part of the party, because the worm has turned. This guy buys the broken idol for scrap. Mysterious fella, for sequel bait, basically.
Yeah. And then we get an epilogue, which is, here to make sure everything is fully, is clear, where we've got to use, we're not gathering words. Like, we get a little bit of dialogue. Most of this is just, basically a summary of the events of the game to make sure that you understand what happened. So we've got Edmund Cloudsley, Walter Keene, and David Gorin meeting up together, formulating their plan. And this is shortly after the explosion of the cabin, right?
Yep.
And we reconstruct this. Edmund thinks that the Brotherhood of Mass does not know what to do with this technology that they had, specifically with the idol. And he thinks that he can use it to assemble his ideal society. But really, his main grievance is the fact that Mary, this young woman that he had his eye on, ran off with Peter, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then this, we've already talked about all this stuff, but this is the kind of the key. Yes. This is where we learn that Edmund convinced Walter to help him subvert the Brotherhood and take it over. And the big kind of reveal, there have been hints of this stuff, but Edmund is Lazarus.
Yes.
He used the de-aging to come back. So he faked his death, had David Gorin lie to the coroner, came back as a young man to infiltrate the Brotherhood.
Yeah.
And take it over, but he kept getting distracted by that pussy.
Yeah. You know, and, you know, on the very morning of him being able to possibly usurp the throne of this empire, got distracted, but wanted to go and kidnap his ideal wife and fucked
got
it up.
Killed by a cannon.
Yeah.
As you got shot by a cannon by a shithead.
Yeah.
the kind of Shaggy Dog story.
Yeah.
Ending of this. it is very good. I think that when I think about, thinking about the continuum of this, the characters in this are all well sketched. At the end where we kind of start, like the final chapter, part of the reason why the final chapter doesn't work for me is I'm invested in kind of the story of this as containers for things, but none of them as characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's different than me saying like the characters aren't likable.
Yeah.
It's that the nature of the narrative, as it were, in this is a narrative where things happen, you know, not really where like characterization or humanity happens in it.
Yeah.
Like it functions weirdly as a story.
It is a story that concerns people, but the people are all very static. Right.
Yes.
It takes place over 40 years and, you know, people live and die. You know, there's aging. You see a little bit of people's crapulence being expressed in a different way. This is not a story where people grow.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's okay. That's not a problem. But I think about just applying to Gary Knipp and specifically thinking about this in comparison to Hypnospace or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, which is maybe a weaker detective game and has weaker puzzles, but I care about the people in it.
Yeah.
So the stakes are there in a way. And this is, this game knows what it is. It's not trying to make you care about the people. And part of that is underlined by the ending of just having like, oh, a guy got hit by a cannon. You know,
bye.
It was all for being petty for women. Lol.
Yeah.
You know, it's doing that on purpose. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just kind of a thing. It touches a part of me. It doesn't quite get the combination of head and heart that I always want.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It ends up making this for me a very good game, but not like one of my all-timers.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little bit of sugar I want with the medicine that is missing from this for it to be an all-timer and ends up being something like, you know, a very solid like B+ for me, but probably objectively like an A, you know, for people. But just in terms of my taste, ends up being something I liked a lot.
Yeah,
but a sometimes treat with emphasis on, you know, with treat being very operative.
Mm-hmm.
And that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You know, and it's worthwhile to put this on a continuum, I think, because they're very different games that broadly have a similar appeal. You know, you're doing something, you know, very similar, in each of these, and anytime there are the similarities, it is worth heightening those distinctions. For me, as somebody who enjoys all three of these and wishes I could play them again, it's just a matter, I'll take any of it. Like, you know, any of these three, you know,
they're rare enough that I understand that, you know, as a thing, cause it just doesn't come up very often.
Yeah.
You know, there's like three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they all excel at, you know, kind of different stuff. Right. And you know, I think that is interesting, and, you know, discerning the texture there, you know, even if, you know, I do, you know, put probably Hypnospace on top as well. If we had to rank them, this would be a pretty close second. It doesn't mean that I am turning away Oberdin if it's standing on my door in the rain, you know.
I like that game a lot. It feels like that was damned a lot by comparison in this.
Yeah.
And there are things that does better. I like the soundtrack of that game better. The presentation of it's revelatory.
Yeah.
And it has innovation awards. Like, this wouldn't exist without it in a literal sense.
Yeah.
You know, because of the direct line of influence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just like more types of puzzles, I guess. And that's because I am a dabbler in this genre. I'm not a devotee.
Yeah. You know, and I am like 75% of a sicko. on this. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to go, you know, full on logic grid. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not playing a fool's errand, right? Or a fool in his money, which is the very, very far end. But like, for participating in a detective story that absolutely puts the burden on me to figure it out and does not like systematize the gathering and connecting of evidence in a way that utterly infantilizes me. Like, this is, you know, you're not working entirely without a net, because this is systematized and thought through in a way to guide you through.
There's a degree of rigor to this, though. Like, actually doing the thing. You do the things in this that your character, that your avatar does in L.A. Noire.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, you have to actually do it. Mm-hmm. And part of the price they paid to do that, I think, is divorcing this from a sense of character. Mm-hmm. Like, I have seen discourse around this game. People who, you know, this is a very loved game. Really, really well reviewed. People have failed to connect with it. One of the reasons they fail to connect with it is because you don't play like a character who is part of the world.
Yeah.
It's not telling a mystery story in an exact way. Mm-hmm. To me, I think that allowed for more interesting puzzles.
Yes.
For me, specifically, there's a YouTube video I watched that was just like, this is a deductive puzzle game, not a detective game. Mm-hmm. And I turned into the Joker. a little bit. I kind of turned into the Crown, the criminal, and the comedian.
Yeah.
For a second.
This is funk rock, and what we need is funk rock.
We need is rock funk. Yeah. You know, and it just like, yeah, I guess. You know, and it just it being a thing where finding out over the course of the show that I have very specific opinions as to what counts as detective work, mm-hmm. and this clears that bar.
Yeah.
You know, as well as anything else mm-hmm. we've done. Like, you're doing deduction mm-hmm. in this, and that's rare and good.
It's on you, and it is a delight to have that burden put on me as the player.
Yeah, way rarer than it should be or seems like it is.
Yeah,
a lot of things come out that are not that.
Right.
You know,
and a lot of things come out that are not that that pretend to be.
Tons of things, you know, where it's just reading a novel in a different order. Like, you're not, I think that for me, detective work has to have a system attached to it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just reading a book.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. So, so good. Great game. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Love it.
If you have anything to say about Case of the Golden Idol, please write in by January 15th. Also, if you have anything to say about Darkest Dungeon 2 or January's premium game, Blasphemous 2.
Yeah.
Write in by... January 15th, duckfeed.tv/contact.
If you have thoughts about multiple games, please separate them into multiple responses. Keep them brief, about two paragraphs, and keep them specific.
If you have thoughts about February's games,
write
in as well by February 15th. Those games are Crazy Taxi.
Yeah.
Unavowed and Age of Empire 2, the definitive edition. That's the version we're going to play.
The 2019 one, the most recent iteration of that game to come out, makes sense to do the most recent one.
If you are not demographically identical to us, so meaning you're not a straight white male cis, you know, if you're not just us, mm-hmm. And you have a project you'd like us to shout out, please write in at gary@duckfeed.tv. Include links, a description, pronouns, things like that. Mm-hmm. This episode, we'd like to shout out a zine called The Collect Call of Cthulhu. This is a cosmic horror, short story, poem, photography, music zine, described as a mix between Cormac McCarthy and Stephen King. Mm. You can find this at collectcallofcthulhu.com.
No.
The person who did it is choosing to remain anonymous, so mm-hmm. that's fine. Just shout out the work. You can sign up for updates at that website. Get the some stuff, but it's also you can buy the zine. We encourage mm-hmm. you to do so. And
cool.
Check it out.
CollectCallOfCthulhu.com.
Yeah. And again, if you have something, please write me an email.
Please.
Be happy to shout you out. Mm-hmm. If you like us, head on over to patreon.com/duckfeedtv. You'll get this month's bonus episode on Blasphemous 2. You'll get our new show, Real Lich Hours. You'll get Elden Ring coverage. You'll get bonus Abject Sufferings, Unfillable, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Jam-packed with content waiting for you. Not just the most recent stuff, but at your tier, you're going to get everything from it. So check out the premium episodes. Those are good. We'd like those. Those are big games.
We think so.
Yeah. It only gets more valuable every month that you're on there. You can also rate or review this podcast or any of the others, especially Real Lich Hours, our Baldur's Gate 3 podcast. and subscribe in your podcast directory of choice.
Yeah.
And also, finally, join us in thanking
us for thanking Gwen.
Yeah, thank us, Gwen. Join us. We're like right at the end. We're right at the end. We're about to take a break, so yeah. we're kind of
okay. Just, we're trying.
Yeah, we're working on fumes here, getting across the finish line. Yeah. But thank you, Gwen, our producer. This is we're recording this at the end of the first year. Have her on board. She's great.
Mm-hmm. It's been really nice.
Yeah.
We appreciate her. Take care, everybody. And what should they watch out for until next time, Cole?
Watch out for new orders.